This is Michael Matheson Miller, and you are listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. Thank you again for listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. My guest today is Father Cajetan Cuddy. He is a Dominican priest, and we are going to talk about a book that he edited by the late Father Robert Edward Brennan, also Dominican, called Thomistic Psychology, a Philosophical Analysis of the Nature of Man. And Father Cuddy edited this book and also wrote an introduction to it as well. A little bit about Father Cajetan Cuddy. Father Cuddy is a priest of the Dominican province of St. Joseph. He serves as the general editor of the Thomistic Tradition series, and he is co-author of Thomas and the Thomists, The Achievement of St. Thomas Aquinas and His Interpreters. He's written for numerous publications on the philosophy and theology of St. Thomas Aquinas and the Thomistic tradition, moral philosophy, metaphysics, and on and on. So I think you're going to find his work and on our conversation very interesting. So we don't often think of St. Thomas as a psychologist, but because he's such a wonderful philosopher of the human person, he understands our will, our intellect, our memory, emotions. He gives clear models and practical advice on how to address problems, how to fight bad habits, build good habits, how to deal with our emotional life, and a roadmap on how to live well. And St. Thomas takes very seriously our embodied nature. As St. Thomas says, and we talk about in the podcast, I am not my soul. And so sometimes you'll see errors, especially in psychology, moving towards a type of spiritualism or a type of materialism where we're just our neurobiology. But Thomas, I think, finds a very solid middle road, recognizing that we are embodied, embedded persons. And so I think you're going to find this conversation with Father Cuddy very, very interesting and very helpful. Related to St. Thomas and psychology, I'm actually preparing some short videos on philosophy and Catholicism that I'll be working on over the next couple months, including some videos on vices, virtues, and the daughters of the virtues and the daughters of the vices, and how understanding these can practically help us. So these aren't ready yet, but if you go to themoralimagination.com and subscribe, I will let you know when I begin releasing these videos. Before we begin, thanks again to all of you who have written reviews of the podcast. If you like the podcast and you haven't given it a rating yet, please go to Apple Podcasts and give it a 5-star review. And if you have time, even write a review. I would appreciate it. Thanks again to all of you who have supported me on Patreon. The podcast does cost time and money, so I appreciate those who have supported it. And finally, the show notes for this, links to books and articles we discuss, and all old episodes can be found at themoralimagination.com. And you can also subscribe there to a newsletter that I send out. It's an occasionally where I'll put links to podcasts or to essays I've written, and also some short book reviews or podcast or reading recommendations of things that I've come across that I find interesting and that I think are worth reading or listening to. And you can find all of that and subscribe at themoralimagination.com. So thank you again for listening, and I hope you enjoy my conversation on Thomistic psychology with Father Cajetan Cuddy.
All right. Thank you, Father Cuddy, for joining the Moral Imagination Podcast.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Father, I want to talk to you about a book that you edited by Father Robert Brennan called Thomistic Psychology. It's a philosophical analysis of the nature of man. And you, in your introduction and in other places, say this is an important book. You said the book deserves careful attention, right? Because it's dealing with the human person. Now, psychology, of course, is a dominant area, and we don't tend to think of St. Thomas as a psychologist, right? But Father Brennan is making the case that there is a rich Thomistic psychology. So maybe let's just start big picture, and then we'll dive in. Tell me, like, why do you think this book is so important? Why did you bring it out? I mean, it's a little bit out of date, maybe in line with some of the science. Why do you think it's so important, and what does Thomistic psychology have to offer our contemporary discussion?
I think this book is important, even with some of, as you noted, the scientific datedness elements to it, because Father Brennan, like Thomas Aquinas, like Aristotle, was interested in reality. And today, with conceptions of the human person, questions psychological, often a focus on reality as an end, as a goal, true knowledge about real things is not only not achieved, it's not sought, but some don't even think it's possible. And what Father Brennan does with great effectiveness, and the reason why I think he's still useful today, is that he was able to articulate elements of Aquinas' teaching, which are admittedly very sublime, sometimes quite intricate, with great clarity, precision, and care. And so in terms of a book that goes over the questions about the nature of the human person, about the nature of the human soul, and about how human persons and human souls interact with the real world around us, I don't know of another book that quite was able to do all that Brennan does with the clarity of style, the accuracy, and the profundity of ideas. And one other thing, even though sure, and I noted in my foreword that some of the ideas or on the scientific side might be a little dated, Brennan brings in this book the fundamental principles about the nature of reality. And those never change. And so underneath the book, informing the book, are things which are not out of date, because they never grow out of date, because being and non-being will always be really distinct, and human persons will always be inclined towards truth and goodness. And so even though this book was written, you know, in the last generation of scholarship or so, I think it does still have a great profit and utility today.
Yeah, good. No, I think so too. And I think you're right. There's a lot of clarity. He summarizes, I've been studying St. Thomas for years, and there's a couple of paragraphs you think, oh, that's great. I understand it a lot better than I did, and it's valuable, right? He goes through pretty quickly. But your comment, two things stand out. One is, I think you kind of are referring to this fundamental understanding of St. Thomas, that truth is the conforming of the mind to reality. And this seems to be, maybe before we get into the psychology, this idea, and maybe why psychology, how it can be beneficial, that we have to take truth seriously. And if we have a distorted understanding of truth or distorted, we don't conform our minds to reality, then in a sense, we become psychologically unhealthy. I mean, how would you react to that?
Absolutely. I think the fundamental conviction of Aristotle, and then later of St. Thomas Aquinas, and later still of Father Robert Brennan, was that human persons are meant to know reality. And that, as you said, reality shapes, it informs the human mind, and through the human mind, the human will, love, and even the emotions, human passion. And if we don't have that proper order, namely that reality comes first, and then the human person as a whole, and the human soul in particular, are conformed to reality, then quite honestly, we become separated from reality because we have no contact with reality, or we deny that reality exists. And either of those two possibilities, human person separated from reality, or the absence of reality outside the human person, are not very attractive or satisfying prospects, because we're radically secluded from all things. And I think today in our contemporary period, to speak about the relevance of this book and what its topic is, you know, everyone struggles today with sadness, with depression, confusion, feelings of isolation. And one wonders if it isn't exactly because we have this false notion about what the human nature of the human person is ordered to, namely reality, truth, and goodness. And because we misunderstand that, we're not able to, for lack of a better word, reach out of ourselves and encounter real being, real people, and experience real love, real union, real unity, even in culture, not just on the individual level. Mm. And so, in a word, I think Father Brennan's book and the principles he articulates with such care lie as the antidote to many of the societal problems that have come in the wake of modern philosophy and the rise of even more modern philosophy.
I think a couple things from that stand out. I mean, I would like later, one of the things I was thinking about is I want to ask how Thomistic psychology specifically addresses questions of, say, anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorders or isolation or different things that, you know, people are concerned about. The reason I say this, I think it's important to that. You know, I spend to my kind of area is philosophical anthropology. And in one sense, psychology is a subset of that, right? And Father Brennan takes some time to go through, say, the philosophical connections. So let's talk a little bit about what psychology is. But I also want to say, I think right in the beginning, before he even talks about psychology, even in your introduction,
you stress something that I think is absolutely essential to both to Aristotle and Aquinas, which is the fact that the study of man, psychology, we'll get into it deeper, but that psychology is the study of the human person, right? And his acts and his emotions, et cetera. But that it's the study of human persons who are ensouled organisms, who are embodied persons. And it's not simply a prior, there's a case for the fact that we're ensouled organisms, and we'll talk about that. But it seems to me that one of the deepest confusions that we have today in psychology, and also just not only in say, academic psychology or philosophical psychology, scientific psychology, but also just in our own lives, is we don't take seriously or understand embodiment. We have this idea that we're driving around in our bodies like we're driving around in a car. And that's an error like that both Aristotle and Aquinas go right after. Why don't you maybe start by talking about that biological element? And maybe let me put it one more way. It's like, and correct me if you disagree with me. I've talked about this before on the podcast. I think there's a strong materialism now rooted in biology and neurobiology. And that explains a lot about the human person, but it's insufficient. And then the reaction to that is spiritualism. But that's an error too. And that one of the reasons I think Thomistic psychology and Aristotle are so important is because they actually take the person as an ensouled organism seriously. They take biology and the soul seriously. Do you want to comment on that a little bit?
Sure. I think I agree completely with your analysis and the care with which you frame tensions which exist in our contemporary reflections on the world, the universe. And I think you're exactly right. One of the challenges, we all intuit naturally, we might say, that there is a spiritual reality. And in fact, it's hard. You have to kind of callous yourself and reason aggressively in kind of a self-delusional way to deny any possibility of a supernatural or a spiritual level. We kind of intuit that. We know that not everything that exists is reducible to matter, to physical stuff. We know that there's a spiritual element to the universe. And on the other hand, we live our life eating food, walking on dirt, hearing sounds. So we know also that there is a material component, material principles to the universe, to the reality in which we live. And so reconciling those two things, different types of beings, material beings, the possibility of spiritual beings, and how those touch, interact, or coordinate is one of the great challenges of the modern period. And what is fascinating, as you know, some Thomists and some Aristotelians have articulated or given a pseudo definition of the human person, integrating both of these things to say that man, woman, the human person is a microcosmos. What they mean by that historically was that in the human person, you have both of these principles, spiritual reality and physical reality, both in their robust spirituality and in their physicality coming together, because the human person, uniquely of all beings, is both spiritual and material in a single acting substance, namely the human person. And so what makes the study of the human person and of psychology interesting is that by studying the human person, one is really studying these two spheres of reality, materiality and spirituality, in one uniquely configured substance, namely the human person.
So let's talk about that. So I was going to ask this later, but let me start it now. Like if you listen to St. Thomas and you start thinking about the intellect and the will and matter and substance and essence and all of these things, and so it can sound a little bit contrived, like, wow, I mean, Aristotle and Thomas, they made up a lot of words to just describe something. And contemporary psychology and say neuroscience can seem at least a little bit more kind of straight to the point. But when you start to push on these things, you start to see, well, wait a minute, this isn't really contrived. And in fact, we're seeing in contemporary neuroscience, people are looking at Aristotle and say, wait a minute, some of this stuff's in the Treatise on the Soul, right? Some of the things that we're finding about the way human beings and the brain operates. Why don't we take a little bit of time to go into some of these foundational questions of what does it mean to be an ensouled organism? And we'll talk maybe also a little bit about the principle of hylomorphism. You said you know James Madden, who wrote a book on hylomorphism. So I'm going to have a podcast on hylomorphism. I mean, this is going to, like, literally dozens of people around the world are going to be excited for this podcast on hylomorphism. I mean, it's going to break down the servers. But let's actually talk about Thomas's concept, rooted in Aristotle, of the person as an ensouled organism. So let's first start, like, what is a person? You started a little bit, is a person is this composite. So a person is an ensouled organism. So what's a soul and what's a body for Thomas?
Sure. So the traditional definition which Aquinas assumes and uses in his Thomistic psychology, in his own psychology, is that a person is an individual substance of a rational nature. And human persons are individual substances of a rational nature that have a body and a soul. And the body and the soul play into their substance, what they are, and even who they are. And so for Aquinas, Aquinas identifies not two parts, not two divided entities that are kind of hoisted or forced together, but two principles, namely the soul, spiritual principle, and a body, the material principle, which when united in the human person, are a separate individual united thing. And so for what Aquinas explains is that the soul of the human person serves as the form of the body. The form of a substance is its animating principle. It's its principle of intelligibility. It's its principle of life. And yet that is not to deny that the principle of life, the soul, really enlivens biological, material, physical extension, namely our body. And so what Aquinas tries to emphasize again and again and again with profound realism is that the human person is both physical and spiritual, and there is no fundamental, ontological, metaphysical, to use the fancy language, we might say essential division between them. And in fact, the human person is an essential, a unity, a profound unity of matters, material and spiritual. When I say he's a realist, what's fascinating is he always cautions against an over-spiritualistic understanding of the human person. He reminds us again and again, for example, that we are not angels and that we are not God. We have physical reality, which must also, thankfully, plays an important role in human life and human flourishing in the human experience. So he's not looking to have an overly spiritual conception of the human person. But on the other hand, he also doesn't think that mere biological processes, mere material change or movement or motion can account for the dynamics of the human person. And that the soul, the spiritual principle, does also provide essential key components of human nature and human action and human flourishing. And so if I had to give Aquinas for the modern period kind of a title, you know, who is St. Thomas Aquinas? I would say, oh, he's the reality guy. He's the guy that wants to take seriously all aspects, all principles that we encounter that exist in the world, and particularly all principles and all aspects that exist in the human person. And these aspects which exist in the human person and make up the human person are physical, material, yes, but also spiritual and intellectual. And so I think today, if people begin with a little help, because some of the language can be technical, which is why Father Brendan is so useful for clarifying and explaining what Aquinas means, I think the modern period will be very taken with Aquinas's profound insight about what it means to be a human person.
You know, I think the point about reality is important. So, I mean, Aquinas has these languages, I am not my soul.
Yes.
Right? Which is really important because I think there, it tends to be, especially among, say, Christians, this idea, oh, well, my real self is my soul. No. I'm not my soul. And so for Aquinas, death is the most unnatural thing.
Yes.
And also, and if you take it theologically, there's the resurrection of the body, which I think is important. So let me go through a couple things and correct me or refine this. Do you first begin with the definition of a person, which is an individual substance of a rational nature, right? Mm-hmm. And then surprisingly, maybe you say, well, but a human person is an individual substance of a rational nature that's embodied. Right? Is that close enough?
Mm-hmm.
So for Aquinas, there's three kinds of persons, right? There's divine persons, there's angelic persons, and then there's ensouled organisms or human persons that are embodied.
Yes.
But that our personhood, our body is not accidental to our personhood, right? It's not like we have our person, then we just kind of show up in the body and then we escape from it. So what's, I think, very interesting about this is Aristotle, you know, in some ways is almost a materialist, right? I mean, that's a strong statement, but like he's compared to Plato, he's like right there, everything's instantiated. And Aquinas doesn't follow Plato, right? He doesn't follow Descartes. Obviously, that's anachronistic, but you know what I mean?
Sure.
He's saying, no, we're embodied. And so I'm jumping here, but one of the things that strikes me, I always think about, like, what's the remedy for sadness for Thomas? And, you know, people are like, prayer. And he's like, a hot bath, good meal.
Yes.
Strong drink.
Like, wait. Glass of wine. Yes. That's right.
Right. Right. And it's like for Wojtyla, who's, that is John Paul II, who's also both phenomenologist, but really shaped by Thomas. It's also interesting. I used to teach philosophy of love and sexuality. I think I talked about this in the podcast once, but I taught philosophy of love and sexuality for a couple of years, semesters. And I would say, okay, what's the beginning of love according to John Paul II? They're like, you know, trust. Like, no, attraction. Wait,
yes.
What? Why? Because we're embodied. And so I think this part, that you say something right at the beginning of your intro. You start out and you're talking about one of the early founders of modern psychology, Wilhelm Wundt. And he's kind of a materialist, right? And he's working on scientific psychology. And then he comes to this point and you quote him. He says, my labors, they don't work with Descartes or Plato. They're really Aristotelian.
Yes.
Because the body matters. Talk about that, I think, because, I mean, I've done some of it, but I think talk about that a little bit of the importance that we are embodied persons, that we're not simply our soul. Because I think this goes to, and again, feel free, Father Cuddy, just push back and say I'm wrong, because maybe I am. But it seems to me like there's many things we have to get right about the human person. We have to get free will, right? We have to get influence, you know, determinism, free will question, which we'll talk about. We've got to get what reason is, right? But it seems if you go to the core of where people are deeply confused, what Aquinas is not is a reductionist. He's not a spiritualist and he's not a materialist. He's a hylomorphist. He believes in embodied persons. And I think that's, to me, I think that's a key thing that so many people, including people who are very serious about, say, their Catholic faith, get wrong. What do you think?
I agree 100%. And it's funny you mention the Catholic faith because we see, you know, I'm a Catholic priest, so these are things that I'm interested in, how Catholics think and how people think about the Catholic Church and the Catholic faith. I agree completely with what you said. And I see a misunderstanding about the human person happening both on what we could call, for lack of a better word, the secular sphere, non-religious, non-Catholic, non-Christian people today, and also amongst many Christians, even devout evangelical Christians, and certainly among devout Catholics, where you have a misunderstanding shared between both groups about the nature of the human person. And with Catholics or Christians, we are so spiritual. You know, faith is important. Faith is not a material thing. That's a theological virtue infused by God in the human intellect. And so it's a habitus. It's a stable disposition that's spiritual. And because faith and then hope and then charity are so important, and those are not physical things. I never see charity walking down the street. I don't see faith blowing in the wind. It's spiritual. And because these spiritual things are so central, I can erroneously begin to frame the influence of faith, hope, and charity, or the range of influence of faith, hope, and charity to the level of the spiritual. And so if I'm going to be transformed, as all Christians are supposed to be and believe that we are called to be, by faith, hope, and charity, and if faith, hope, and charity are spiritual, I can begin, again, erroneously to think that my transformation as a human person in and by faith, hope, and charity will result in a more spiritual existence. And so in many ways, some people, even if we don't say it like this, some Catholics, some evangelicals might really be thinking that the Christian life is becoming an angel, losing the bodily, losing the material component of that hylomorphic body-soul unity. And that is completely false, because for Christians, I would say, if we were to become angels, that would not be salvation, because salvation is the redemption of what we are, and we are not angels. That would not be salvation. That would be a form of transubstantiation of a sort, where we become something different, leaving our humanity and becoming an angel. And, you know, sed contra, as Aquinas would say, you know, that's not true, because God came, sent his eternal son, Jesus, to save human persons as they are. So I would caution all Christians, Protestant, evangelical, Catholics, to avoid falling into an angelistic misconception of the human person and to think that we are called to lose our body, to lose our sensate life in our quest for holiness, which is not true. Holiness is an incarnated project. We become holy and spiritual, but spiritual even in our physicality. On the other hand, if I may, I would also, and I love to talk to secular people and listen to them articulate and hear how they reflect upon reality, upon the possibility of God or the denial of God if they deny him. Because one of the things we often say today is, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious.
I'm the opposite.
You're very exceptional, Michael, I will say. But what's fascinating about being spiritual but not religious is that too has this angelistic understanding of what the human person is, because right. We think that, you know, I don't need to go to church. I don't need to go to mass. I don't need to go to the synagogue or wherever. I can go to my room, close my door, and have a spiritual experience by, you know, thinking, having ideas, meditation. But nobody really believes that, because if, you know, you and I were offered football tickets for Super Bowl Sunday, 50-yard line, you know, right there out at the front, and somebody offered these to us and said, would you like these? And we respond, you know what? I'm not really a football fan in the religious sense. I'm a spiritual football fan. So I'm going to go home, sit on my couch, and meditate about the Super Bowl, meditate about football. And for me, that's good enough. Of course, we know that's ridiculous, because part of what it means to be a fan of something is to get involved with it, which means certainly spiritual reflection, thought, love, even emotion, but also on the level of bodily presence. We want to be there. We want to smell the football field. We want to hear the sounds. We want to watch with our own physical eyes the players play the game. And so what's ironic is, even though there's a great divide, it would seem, between Christians, Catholics, and secular people, they both share in different ways this fundamental same error about the human person. And that is that we are not angels. We are a union of body and soul. We are human persons.
Right. Yeah. It's a, I did a podcast with Jay Richards, who's actually a third order Dominican. I got to get some Franciscans or somebody on here now. He wrote a book on fasting, talking about how we think about fasting or just liturgy. I mean, I think the sociology of liturgy is very important. I mean, obviously there's the theological and spiritual elements, but the fact that like we pray with our bodies. And I mean, and Jay actually brought up that St. Dominic has these eight prayer posture positions, and other people do. There's this idea of how you pray, how you hold your body matters. So I think the football analogy is a good one. So there's a couple of things we could go from there. So when we think about psychology, right, we think about our own mental health and our own psychological experiences. We're thinking about the senses. We think about our intellect, our emotions, our imagination, and how all those things need to be ordered. But for Thomas, that seems to come through the senses. So the senses are really important. Could you maybe just give like a primer on St. Thomas and the senses? Because I think it would be helpful, I mean, for me, and I think it'd be helpful for listeners, of how important the senses are for St. Thomas in our broader experience as a human person and psychologically as well.
Sure. Yes, I agree completely. Again, the senses are first in the order of sequence in terms of knowledge and of the human encounter with reality, because it is through the senses that we have knowledge of anything. Aquinas was not a Platonist. He did not believe that ideas were infused spiritually into the mind apart from sensate sense experience. And some have said, and I think rightly, justly, that the senses are the gateway to the soul. So we're right to begin here. Through the five senses of the human person, we are comported, we are configured to be able to interact with physical beings, with external reality, in the physicality, the materiality of their external reality. And so through light, I'm able to see color. Through the sense of touch, the sense of touch is supremely important for Aquinas. I'm able to feel texture, feel density, sound, vibrations in the air. I can pick up on that. So what the senses do is they enable us in kind of a holistic way from various aspects to encounter really and truly material, physical reality outside of ourselves. And the senses, because they're uniquely configured to, proportioned to materiality, And the senses are the way in which we as human persons can reach out and touch, sometimes quite literally, the external reality among us. And what's interesting is when the senses receive data from the external material physical reality, that is then brought into the human person, that experience, those objects, the impressions of those objects are brought into the human person. And subsequently, that ends up becoming spiritualized and processed. And we're able to remember things that we experienced physically, you know, 10 years ago. I'm no longer physically experiencing them, but my intellect is able to, through the imagination and memory, able to hold on to these things. But the senses, to come back to your fundamental question, the senses are essential and primary in terms of sequence, because if there is a reality out there, and if that reality has a physicality, the senses enable us to meet reality on that fundamental physicality, materiality level. And that's where we start the process of knowledge and of learning and of human flourishing and living. And we see this with children. I mean, children, young newborn babies, you know, they bring them home and they begin to grow, and little children start to, you know, they want to touch things, they want to taste things, they want to smell things.
I have one.
Yeah, there you go. See? And yeah, and that's a part
right now,
of
I'm you can 3 month old.
Well, yeah, well, you really do. Yeah, you've seen this in real time. And and it's very fascinating, because what's happening there is we're experiencing the world as the world is. I mean, the world, you can taste it, you can hear it, you can see it, you can smell it. And young babies, you know, they don't have any knowledge yet. So they're super sensible. They're supra sensitive. They're trying to learn all of these things. And that's the beginning of human knowledge.
So let me ask you something then from following on this. I mean, so like we're talking about psychology, and right now we're doing a kind of like philosophical work. And I think we do need to address the soul body or the mind body problem and the question of this. But it seems to me that it's real practical elements to this psychologically in our own mental health. So for a Thomistic understanding, we're embodied persons. We're a composite, as we've talked about, of spirit, of matter. And we can go into detail on that with hylomorphism. And so because we know that we're taking everything in through our senses, there's a psychological, a moral element of a guide that says you have to guard your senses, right? And you said, for example, like the body remembers and that what happened 10 years before because it's in your imagination. And so, for example, if you think about mental health, right? Like, why are we careful about the kinds of music we listen to? Why are we careful about the type of movies or television we watch, right? Why are we careful about the things we show people? All right. And if you think about, say, for example, I did a podcast with Noelle Mehring on woke justice, and she talks about some of the proponents of the sexual revolution want to expose young children to sexual perversion early. Right. Whereas we take seriously the fact that we're embodied persons, we want to make sure that we are, how do I say this? Well, you could put it in this kind of classic Thomistic language, that we're focusing on the good, the true, and the beautiful, and guarding our senses, because not only because what we cognitively immediately are aware of, right? But as we've seen from a number of neuroscientific studies, like Joseph Ledoux does this with the amygdala and what happens with danger and fear, right? And so, for example, he'll show somebody a picture of a snake, and they see the snake and they have a biometric reaction to this. I talked about this with Dr. Michael Agnor on a podcast I did on neuroscience. And then he'll show it to the patient or the person and he'll show it, but he shows it so fast that you don't see it, quote unquote. That means you're not cognitively aware that you're seeing it, but your visual neurons are picking it up and the amygdala is picking it up and you're having biometric reactions to it. Well, in a sense, that fits right into a Thomistic Aristotelian point that what's going on, we're taking in more with our senses than we're immediately cognitively aware of. These things are, however you want to articulate it, are being processed, and they come back later, as it were. The body remembers. And so this is why, like, taking the senses very seriously and think, this is why for everybody from Plato to Aquinas to contemporary things, like, music matters. What you watch matters. What you read matters. What you think matters. What you dwell on matters. And a lot of it is back to taking very seriously the senses and the fact that we're embodied persons. How do you react to that? What do you think?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that all that you have said that is very astute and accurate, and certainly true of Aquinas' thought, this reflects, or these, all of these things point to a fundamental truth, and that is this, that the human person is first of all shaped by reality. The human person is first of all shaped by reality, or to express it more directly, reality outside of us shapes us. Can we shape reality? Certainly. We can, you know, get bulldozers, move dirt around, build things, you know, establish groups, societies. But fundamentally, so we can have an active role. We don't want to deny that, as neither you nor I nor Aquinas do deny that.
By the way, I always like to be, when it's like, when neither me nor Father Cuddy nor Thomas Aquinas, I always like to be included like Thomas Aquinas. So thanks for that.
we're the elite triumphant here, pontificating on this podcast. Wonderful. Yes. So us three, we do not affirm. We do not deny that the human person can have an active influence and shape parts of reality. However, we three also maintain that first and foremost and primary and significantly and noteworthily, we are shaped by reality first. And this pushes up against something in the modern culture. I think that the modern world, if we reflect on the views of society, views of family, views of the human person, views of human sexuality, views of education, views of politics, what has happened in the modern society is that we have actually inverted that order. I think today we kind of think that reality doesn't shape us so much as we shape it. And in fact, what we're afraid of now and what we're suspicious of now is that the world, that nature, that reality, and then society and institutions, that they shape us. In other words, the shaping that we receive, we view that with suspicion. Anything that we don't actively make, form, formulate, or consent to, we view all of those things, even in their distant identity, even if they're not encroaching upon us, but the fact that they exist, because we did not make them, we think implicitly that they are aggressors towards us. While for Aristotle and for Aquinas, that would not necessarily be the case because they understood that the human person is primarily, in terms of the first instant, passive. We are shaped by reality, by what we sense, by our knowledge of things, by what we learn, by our family, by our friends, by music, by films. And that is exactly why, as you have rightly said, we must be attentive to the shaping influences which come into us because we are fundamentally passive when it comes to encounters with reality.
No, like we're formed. Human formation exactly matters. And I think, again, what you're articulating in Thomas that's so important is he's not reductive. This is why I think Thomas and Aristotle are really important for contemporary psychology and neuroscience. They're not reductive. They're taking all these things together. And so, you know, one, I think you're right. There's this almost suspicion of anything that is somehow not technocratically made. So I think we live in a technocracy where we think we can, in a sense, shape everything, including reality. Now, and again, for Thomas, right? Thomas does have a teaching of self-creation, right? But it's not the existentialist self-creation of someone like Sartre or Marx, right? It's a self-creation within an essence. And I think this is something that also Father Brennan gets to early in his definition of psychology. And one more thing before that. It's also that's part of taking the reality of the passive nature is very important for our mental health. So it's not saying, oh, we're just passive creatures who don't do anything, right? Because in the biblical Genesis narrative, right, we're to be fruitful and multiply, to have dominion over the earth, right? So we're to complete creation. And technology is something to be affirmed as good. And I think I think actually one of the best articulations of how to think about technology and progress and hope is actually in Benedict the 16th encyclical Spes Salvi.
There you go.
Have you read that?
Okay. I have.
It's so good. And I think encyclicals are so boring, right? But this one's not. Right. I mean, since that's actually what purgatory is going to be, right? It's not just making license plates. You're going to be making license plates and reading encyclicals, right? But this one, it's really powerful on the progress. So that whole sense that we're both passive and creative. And if we take them both seriously, then we have mental health. But I think this goes, I was going to say to Father Brennan's kind of the way that when he talks about, say, the scientific psychology and the philosophy of psychology, that they're united in the sense that Aquinas is dealing with the subject of psychology is the person, right? Is the person in the world. And it seems like, as you said, we either want to overly focus on the person or overly focus on the world. And there's that tension there. So if you want to comment on that, but then I have a couple questions for you. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Sure. No, I don't have much to add. I think that's true. I do very much appreciate the writings of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI. I think he's very wise and insightful and incisive in his analysis there. And I think, yes, this balance between the human person as both passive and active agent, as someone who is changed by and who effects change in reality, is significant. And in terms of mental health, if the only thing I know we agree on this without even asking, is that the human person is meant to find happiness. And that's the fundamental. If you want to ask, what is Aquinas' big picture point of all of his thousands of pages of philosophical, theological writing? It's this: the human person is meant to find happiness, and ultimately God provides that, the fulfillment, the satisfying of that desire for happiness. That's the big picture. And what we're talking about now is, how is the human person made happy? Well, the human person is made happy by the various powers of the human person, like the senses, like the body, bodily powers, like the rational powers of the intellect and the will. If they find, meet, receive, encounter their proper objects, they will contribute to the holistic happiness of the human person. And so the human intellect is made to know the truth. The human will is ordered towards universal goodness, goodness absolutely. And the sense appetites, bodily desires, the emotions, they're ordered to concrete, sensible goods. And for the human person, therefore, to be happy, we need to sense, to know, and to love what is truly true, what is truly good, and protect ourselves against false, duplicitous, or ersatz truth and goodnesses. Because if we eat, metaphorically speaking, fake truth, fake goodness, we will not be satisfied and we will not be happy. And the human person's life project, in Aquinas' conception of it, is frustrated. Namely, we will not find the happiness for which we were made.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I think it goes to the point I was actually going to make, and I went off, is that Father Brennan deals with the fact that Aquinas is looking at psychology. He's looking at psychology as the acts and powers of man. It's like, how does the powers of man, the intellect, reason, will, the actions of man, the habits of man, our character, all these things, and we'll go into that here in just a second, but that also man has a nature, that he has by a nature, that it means he's a certain kind of being, and that happiness and mental health and flourishing, both in this world and the next, right? And it's important. It's not, Aquinas is not simply like, you know, otherworldly, right? He's talking about happiness here as well. As we talked about, the remedy for sadness is, you know, a strong drink, and laughter, right? And these things, but that it's, if you have to live according to your nature, and that doesn't mean that everyone lives exactly the same, but that we have to live according to nature. And I think it seems to me, this is one of the strengths of a Thomistic psychology, that it takes the human being as a certain kind of being more seriously than a lot of modern psychology, some of which there's great insights from, but that really don't have a very good philosophical anthropology.
Yes, very much so. Aquinas' true gift, we would not say that he had all of the requisite, perhaps, for lack of a better word, laboratory, clinical data at his disposal. Certainly not. Now we have much more information and data that we can use and we can benefit from modern psychology. But what Aquinas did have that many of modern thinkers, modern scientists, both psychologically and not, we don't have a concern for the big picture. And that's what Aquinas' goal is always. How do all these details fit into a holistic big picture? We would call it a wise, sapiential picture about the whole of reality. And just to home in briefly what you just said about human nature, and this is why, exactly right, that, you know, yeah, human, we tend to think or deny that there is such a thing as the nature of a human person, the whatness of a human person that cannot be changed essentially. It always remains. And the only two possibilities for human nature are to be frustrated and sad, despondent, or to be fulfilled, actualized, and beatified. Those are the only, basically, you can either use the human nature well.
It's not a continuum, but that's where you're going. I mean, you're not always one or the other, but yeah.
Exactly. Thank you. At the final point, yeah, it's one of those two things. And then that sounds to our modern ears is, you know, what kind of artificial self-limiting thing is this? But it's simply that the human person is meant to know the truth about the reality, meant to encounter true goodness. And so anything other than the truth and the good will not satisfy us. And so it's like a fish in a pond. Is being in a pond in a way limiting? Well, I guess. But if you pull that fish out of a pond, what begins to happen? You throw it on the sand or on the bank next to the pond, the fish begins to die. Why? Because it was not made to live outside of water. It was made to live in the water. And so a fish outside the water is not more free because it's living against its fish nature, which requires water. No, it's suffering. And the same with human persons. You know, we might think, well, you guys are saying that we're meant to know the truth and the good and live within order and fulfill human nature. That's limiting. Our response, we would say, well, maybe in terms of an absolute kind of logical sense, but not in a real concrete sense, because what we're saying is truth and goodness perfect you. Just like the fish was made for the water, you were made for truth and goodness. And so we're not limiting your flourishing by encouraging or saying that the human person is ordered to knowledge of truth and goodness, because that's the very thing for which your nature craves and yearns, just like the fish craves, yearns, and requires water.
So let me play devil's advocate for a little bit, you know, because you brought it up already. Like, people would say, I mean, come on, what does that mean? Truth and goodness. I mean, you know, are you saying I just got to become a Catholic and a Dominican? Like, you know, like the thing is, because in one sense, you could say nature, what do you mean nature? Is nature to be a murderer, right? To be a rapist, to be a molester, to be a thief? I mean, we do all of those things. What do you mean we have a nature? Because I mean, I think that's a critique, right? That what's natural right now, if you look, for example, reading Exodus, and there's all these laws in Exodus, okay? And some of the laws in Exodus and Deuteronomy are like, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't do that. Well, that means there must have been people doing some kind of bad stuff that you need the laws, right? So yes. Isn't that natural? What does Thomas mean by nature? Because again, just if you look at like rape, murder, incest, slavery, stealing, you know, violence, brutality, that's the natural way of man. What do you say to that?
So if someone were, I know you're playing devil's advocate, but if I were to imagine
But I have the question.
Sure.
I mean, it is, it's when we say nature, right? It's a hard thing when we say nature. Like when we say natural law, for example, mm-hmm. like, I mean, it's a position that, you know, if you're in a really tough culture or society or period of time or neighborhood or, you know, whatever, natural law looks like survive or get killed.
Sure.
It seems like, I'm just saying, I think the critique could be, yeah, the good, the true, and the beautiful are great when you're well-fed and you're in a nice family, but that's not the norm for lots of people throughout history.
Sure. So in response to that type of question, I would immediately speak about the nature, because what we're talking about now then, we're talking about basically evil and disorder away from the truth and the good and even the beautiful. And so I would press this questioner with sincerity and ask them, well, okay, why are those things bad? Well, I agree that they are, but what are the reasons? Like, well, this is a misuse, you know, with rape, a misuse of human sexuality, you know, murder, a misuse of human life, you know, stealing, unjust.
But it's natural though, right, Father?
But it is natural. But see, here's the thing. I would say that if it's natural, why does it elicit within us this aversion? Corn is natural. The sunset is natural. I don't have the same type of aversion to that, but these things I do. And so what we have to think about now is, why do we have this, and when we're faced with phenomena like this, why do we have such an aversion against them? It's because intuitively we know that these types of behaviors and these types of activities, these types of vices run contrary to the proper order of things. And so what I would try to lead a questioner or explore with the questioner who asked this would be to recognize the fact that evil is itself privative. It's a disorder or a missing the mark of what is really true and what is truly good. And that's what makes it so bad, is that it failed to arrive at what is truly good and what is truly true. And so when we basically, the fact that even though these things occur, we wouldn't call them natural in the same way that we would call a sunset or a tasty corn on a summer afternoon cooked well, good. We would call these things natural insofar as they proceeded from a misuse of nature or a failure to actualize nature properly. They're depraved, deprived of the full realization of what nature yearns. And that's the very reason why we have an aversion to them, is we realize that they have missed the mark. They have not arrived at what was meant to be good. In the case of rape, you know, human sexuality, there's something severely disordered there.
Or use of persons, right?
Misuse of persons.
So there's natural, there's two senses to the word natural, right? It's natural that we do bad things. It's natural that there's rape and murder and slavery, okay? But then there's a deeper sense or a more foundational sense of we are a certain kind of being. And I think Father Brennan actually makes this distinction. That's what we mean here by human nature. We don't mean everything that's done by human beings. We mean that kind of being that we are, which is a rational person. Then we can start, then we can start to say, okay, well, if you're a human person and I'm a human person, and that you're not simply an object to be manipulated for, you know, in the cog of my capitalist machine or communist state or right. Then if I treat you like that, then sin, right, according to the catechism, is an offense against reason, because it's irrational for me to treat you a certain kind of thing in a way that you're not. I mean, is that the distinction?
Exactly. I would say, yes, certainly. So thank you for that. You have summarized beautifully the point. Yes, what we're talking about in this context is the whatness of the human person, and that's what we mean by nature. And the first type of quote nature, those types of behaviors we would call misuses, misactualizations, depraved uses of human nature.
Or of human powers, right?
Human faculties. Powers, yes.
And
yes.
I'm thinking of like Father Brennan's breakdown of Aquinas, right? So you'd have the power of sexuality or strength or something, and mm-hmm. you're using that for violence or for murder or whatever. So maybe, I guess the question, so like we have these powers. I'm going to maybe change the subject here for a second, and let's talk about the powers. Because okay. Aquinas, there are certain part of what he defines, or at least Father Brennan defines as Thomistic psychology, is studying of the powers of man. So like, for Aquinas, we have the kind of being where we're rational and we have a will. Okay. So we have moral responsibility. Now, a lot of people would say we don't have free will. We're just determined by our environment. We're determined by our genes, our neurobiology. How do you respond? And how would Father Brennan, because he addresses this, respond to the critiques of, say, free will and moral responsibility and the proper use of the powers of man? And how that connects to what I'm saying is, I'm quite certain Thomas says there's a proper use of the powers. We have powers and they're supposed to be used properly, right? But other people would say, no, we just have powers and we do what we want. How does Thomas address, and Father Brennan address, this question of, say, free will and the proper use of powers?
Yeah, so the first, to bring it back to the level of nature, Aquinas is, it's interesting, although we speak of free will, Aquinas does not understand free will as a specific power. That's a very important thing. It's not like we have an intellect and a free will and then, you know, our sense appetites. Mm-hmm. Free will or freedom of the will is actually something he predicates of the intellect and the will as a unity. And so what he means by that is he says that the intellect recognizes goodness. I see that the color blue is good. I see that my family is good. And I also see that this pizza is good. They all are perceived as good. And what freedom is for Aquinas is that only something that is seen as good in every respect. There is not a single aspect under which this something that I'm seeing or knowing is perceived as being not good. Only then do I have no freedom, because the will is ordered toward what is good under every aspect.
So could you give an example?
Sure. So So for example, I'll even use God in this example. So the pizza on the table in the other room is good. It's very good. It satisfies my appetite for food. I'm hungry. It smells good. I have fond memories of pizza. So under all those aspects, it's good. But the aspect of it's in the other room and I'm tired and I don't want to get up, or it has anchovies on it, I don't like anchovies, or I had pizza yesterday, I'd like something different today. And this can be done for every good that we encounter or know this side of heaven is seen under aspects of attractiveness and unattractiveness. Even Aquinas points out God. God in himself is pure, infinite goodness. There is no aspect under which God is not desirable. He's desirable under every aspect. But this side of heaven, I don't actually see God in himself as he is. So even for God, even as a priest, you know, God's goodness, he's attracted to me because he's my creator. He's my redeemer. He's the one I've consecrated my life to. I'm his priest. So those are the good aspects, for example. But, you know, sometimes, you know, 5 a.m. in the morning, getting up to say mass or to do, you know, chant the Psalms and our community prayer. At that moment, you know, my bed feels a little more good than getting up and doing these other things. So freedom for Aquinas is located in the human person's perception of the goodness of things. And I am free to choose or not choose different things perceived as good insofar as they are perceived or not perceived as good. If I were to see God, who is pure goodness, as he is, and therefore I'd see him under every aspect as good, I would not be free. So this is fascinating. In heaven, there is no free will, because there's no way the human will would want to turn away from something that has no seeming disadvantage. God is pure infinite goodness. There is no way in which he is not viewed as good. But everything else, and including God, this side of heaven, we perceive as mixed goods. And that is the foundation of freedom. Freedom is based upon our perception in the intellect, and the will being the appetite, the power of choosing of the intellect. That's what freedom is. Freedom is an intellectual, it's grounded in the fact that our intellect perceives things as good under some aspect and good and not good under others. And so with regard to determinism, I would say that determinism is very difficult to maintain, because the fact of the matter is we know that the mixed goods exist and that we have chosen to do certain things. And so determinism basically cannot account for, in a robustly rational way, for the plurality of different types of goodnesses we encounter and the reason behind why I have chosen some good things and not others. The reason why I have chosen some good things and not others comes down to the fact that nothing in this human experience on this earth appears to me as good under every aspect. And only the universal good, the good under every aspect, compels the will such that the will has no freedom when it faces it.
Okay. So, all right. So I think, so to just summarize so I understand it. So if the will is completely compelled and the intellect is compelled, so that in the situation, say, where you see God as perfect, there you wouldn't have free will.
No.
But in every situation where you, except for that, there's always mixed goods and you're not fully compelled. So for Thomas, you would have then reductions. It's the question. Would you have reductions in your freedom if your habits are disordered, or you
certainly
have? So maybe this is we're running out of time here. So let me change the subject here a little bit,
but
follow into it. And that's, you know, Thomas, and even in this conversation, Thomas is a bit hard to deal with, you know, and you're starting to read Thomas. Like, I remember teaching Thomas, like, okay, you have to, like, first you have to figure out how he starts in his language, and, you know, here's the objections, right? And then you start to get that, but it's kind of, in one sense, complex, but it's always, of course, depressing when you're told that the Summa Theologica is really a beginner's text. That's super depressing and always will be. But anyway,
Mind if I say one thing about that, just as encouragement for your listeners?
Yeah.
So many wise people have said, and I have found it true of my experience, that yes, is Aquinas difficult? Certainly. But here's the distinction between Aquinas and other thinkers. With Aquinas, the difficulty comes at the beginning when you're learning the vocabulary, you're learning the distinctions, you're becoming wise. And the more Aquinas you read, the less difficult he becomes. And in fact, you arrive at a place eventually where you can almost intuit, you predict what he will say about a given question before you've even read it, because his principles have become second nature to you. So just to say, for Aquinas, the difficulties first, and then it becomes easier the more time you spend with him. And I've heard other philosophers and theologians say, and I think it's right and it resonates in my experience, that it's exactly the opposite with other philosophers, other thinkers, for whom when you begin reading, it seems, okay, these are clear things. And the more you spend time with that person's book or their thought, the more complex it becomes, in such that at the end of it, it's so opaque, you don't know what's going on. And I think that's very true. So I wish your listeners, just to say, do not be afraid to spend time with Aquinas. It will be a little slow going at the beginning, but unlike other thinkers, simplicity, clarity, and ease comes. Like, for, I don't want to pick on him, but if you try to read Immanuel Kant, you know, my goodness, talk about from, you know, the less known to the still lesser known to the, you know, the lesser, lesser known.
I mean, noumenas and phenomena and all the other things. Yeah. So, yeah, but I think that's right. I am not getting paid to do this, but the Thomistic Institute does have, you guys should support my podcast.
We should support you.
Yeah. Thanks. Go tell everybody to join the Patreon account. But you guys created a really good, kind of introduction to St. Thomas. Little videos, 5 minutes. They're excellent. I highly recommend them. I watch them. I learn from them myself. I've had my children look at them. They're excellent. So I'll put a link to that on the Moral Imagination page for this episode. But in a sense, it's not only that it becomes clear, there's something incredibly practical about St. Thomas, where he helps us understand our own behavior. And so a lot of people want to read psychology because they want to understand themselves. A lot of psychologists become psychologists because they're maybe struggling with their own problems. And Thomas, in that sense, that's where I was moving off Will and things, because I thought as we go toward the end, I'll have one more kind of devil's advocate position. But
sure,
I think Thomas is helpful because he helps us understand our own behavior. And I think one of the ways he does that, and maybe you could elaborate and kind of explain this, is that like how he understands the concept of what you're talking about, like will and choice and habits and character, and then forgiveness, repentance, changing our behavior. You know, so in a sense, like I don't want to be flippant or anything. I'm joking here a little bit, but I mean, it's not only that Thomas becomes clear. Thomas is self-help. I mean, big. I mean, you know, he is really. I would say in my own life, reading Thomas, like thinking through problems, solving a problem I was having interiorly, or relationship, or whatever, or like struggling with a bad habit. Aquinas gives you a real kind of clear model of like how to resist evil, to do good, to build habits. I mean, you want to just take just a couple minutes and maybe like walk us through the very practical elements that St. Thomas's moral philosophy and his psychology are, how they're so helpful for mental health.
Sure. So if I were to give a very brief kind of metaphor to help us understand this point that you've just made, it's if human life is like a child putting a puzzle together or building a toy, you know, all the parts come in the box. And what Aquinas gives us is he gives us the instructions which show what each part does and how they fit together. And it's very hard to put together an intricate thing, a beautiful thing like human life flowing from the human person, if we don't have a roadmap, if we don't have a guide. And that's what Aquinas gives us with great precision, is the guide for how to have, how to live, how to enact a happy human life. And now the reason why he does that, or why all this is helpful, is that he explains the human person is meant to know the true. He's meant to love the good. He or she is meant to experience, even in their emotions, things that enliven them. And all of these things, the truth, the good, sensible goods, these shape the human person and instill within us habits or dispositions that have reality leaves its mark on us through the intellect, through the will, and through the sense appetites, also known perhaps we would say today, the emotions. And then we live our life with these habits, these dispositions that have left their mark on us, but they don't determine us. If I have been lied to my whole life and I'm very confused in my intellect, and now I have a habitus, a habit of confusion or of error, Aquinas reminds us, is that an impediment to, at this moment, living freely, happily Yes, error doesn't help anyone attain freedom or happiness, but I am not determined by this disposition, by this condition. And I can replace that habit of error with a habit of truth. And so for Aquinas, because he sees both the dynamism of the human person and the ability for change that's always present within a stable nature that is always ordered to an encounter with the world, Aquinas gives us a roadmap to help us with great encouragement, with great hope, deal with many of the problems which come in our life. Sin, error is not a big problem for Aquinas. Why is that? Because truth is more powerful than error. Goodness is more powerful than sin. And particularly because he was a priest, through the seven sacraments, Jesus, who is the way, the truth, and the life, can come into our lives and reorder us. And Aquinas has a very profound, sober, hope-filled, and happy conception of the human person. Who we are changes, what we do changes who we are, but what we do does not determine who we are. And we can always be reordered towards the true, towards the good, and ultimately to God himself.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think he's optimistic. I mean, you think of Thomas, you don't think of kind of, he's a happy realist.
Yes.
You know, he's a happy realist. He's optimistic. But he doesn't take sin lightly. He doesn't take evil lightly. He doesn't take difficulty lightly. And I mean, I think one of the areas I think is really good, you know, this would maybe be a whole other podcast, but I like how he goes through the virtues and the vices. And then he has the daughters of the virtues and the vices.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at like the seven deadly sins and the daughters of them and saying, okay. And it's really kind of remarkable when you think, if you want to think psychologically, because we're talking about the psychology of Thomas, right? That psychologically, you spend some time reading on a question of, say, sloth or anger, and then or prudence or whatever, and you start going into the effects of that, the daughters of that, what it is, you can really have deep self introspection that can help give you, as you said, that positive sense. Okay, this has happened to me. It's bad, or this is what I did. It's bad, and you may need direction and help to do it. But Aquinas gives, I think, this way of understanding yourself. And as you said, it's understanding with it, and it's pretty rough. Like he's very, you know, there's like the realist element in psychology where you just, you know, tell people the truth. I mean, Aquinas is definitely a realist, but also in a sense, gentle. Say, okay, this is how you get out of it. This is what you do. And I find that element of Aquinas in a sense, sometimes neglect it, as it were. I mean, not in practice, but I think in how you'd say the promotion of the value of Aquinas, we tend to think of him as kind of focusing on a lot of the things in the speculative element. But in the area of just practical living, the practical intellect, seeking after the good, how to do that, correcting your faults, building your habits, I think he's invaluable. You?
I certainly agree. And the reason for that is, you know, Aquinas thought, you know, the distinction, if people wonder, what's the distinction between practical and speculative? For Aquinas, speculative doesn't mean thinking thoughts for the sake of thinking thoughts the way mm-hmm. we would mean it today. He means by speculative, knowledge for the sake of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And for practical, it means knowledge for the sake of action.
Right. But so the good is to be done, right?
And that's pursued, right.
Yeah.
And for him, these are always united, because you can't know something in order to do something unless you truly know something. So he might say like this, so if my goal in learning about a car is just because I'm fascinated by mechanics, perhaps, I just want to know how a car works, Aquinas would say, well, that's speculative knowledge, because your goal is not to drive the car, it's just to know about it, how it works. But if my goal is to learn how to drive a car and how to drive it well and maintain that car, he would say, well, that's practical knowledge. But he would also, with a twinkle in his eye, say, you also have speculative knowledge there too, because you can't do something unless you know what you're doing. So for Aquinas, he doesn't view a separation, as you know, between the speculative and the practical, because what something is leads to how it operates. And the same for the human person. As you said, he's a happy realist. He's interested in, with great precision, in the whatness, the nature of the human person. But that whatness, that nature, is always ordered to, how can this nature that's meant for truth and goodness for happiness attain it. So the practical flows seamlessly from the speculative. The imperative, the do this type of reflections flow seamlessly from the what is this type of questions.
Yeah, and the answer, and I think that's why, in a sense, his the Thomistic psychology is so important, because it's rooted in also taking the nature seriously. So let me push a couple of questions. What would you say are the biggest weaknesses now of Thomistic psychology, right? In light of, say, scientific discovery, neuroscience, what things do you think are maybe the weaknesses or the things that we've learned that maybe even add on to it or correct it? Or what would you say? How would you answer that?
Well, thank you for that's a very generous question of you. I must admit that I fall into the very thing I'm going to say right now, and that is that this Thomistic philosophers and theologians like myself, we're not as aware enough of modern psychology as we should be. And that's the first thing that, I would say, first of all, would be that the fact that the disciples, the students of Aquinas, are not as engaged in the modern psychological project as we should be. The exception to this, of course, would be the Institute of Psychological Sciences, now known as divinemercy.edu, which is a trying to be very cutting edge in terms of psychological sciences, but also be rooted in Aquinas' fundamental philosophy. I would think, however, if I had to, with great hubris, posit a guess about things I don't know much about, namely modern psychology, is that modern psychology will be able to provide many useful details and specifics, empirically verified and gathered about the biological, the emotional, namely where the soul and the body touch. I think modern psychology is able, through technology and through research methods, able to get a lot more information for knowing about that, the point of connection between the soul and the body that Aquinas did not have at his disposal in the 13th century. So those types of things, those would be the reflections I would have on that. But I would defer to someone like Craig Stephen Titus, who I know is a great student of modern psychology and also of Aquinas. And he certainly puts me to shame when it comes to modern science, because I am not as and that's to my chagrin. We modern Thomists, we should be more attuned to these things. My problem is Aquinas is so vast, so wise. I've just said, I'm not smart enough. I don't have enough time to read everybody, so I'm just going to spend time with him.
Yeah.
But there are some guys who can do both.
Well, I have to. Maybe we'll get Craig Stephen Titus on the podcast. We can talk about it.
He's wonderful.
So, well, it's actually interesting that you, Father Brennan, so in addition to this book on Thomistic psychology, I think you edited, did you edit his book on history of psychology as well?
I did not.
Okay, because he has a whole history of psychology, which is pretty, pretty fast, and it's a good one. But what's interesting, so in his book, chapter 4, it's called The Vegetative Life of Man, here in the Thomistic psychology book that you edited, he talks about what you just said a little bit. He said, speaking of idealists and their attitude towards the mind-body problem, Aquinas remarks sharply, in focusing their attention on the nature of the soul alone, Plato and the other philosophers like him overlooked the equally necessary task of discussing the nature of the body, why the body is appropriate for the soul, what sort of body is united with the soul, how the union of body and soul is actually accomplished. And then he says, that's end quote, that's Aquinas. And then Father Brennan says, it's quite inevitable, in fact, that Platonists should fail to grasp the true nature of the soul when they so studiously neglected to consider the body. And he said, I dare say if the angelic doctor were alive today, St. Thomas would make it his business to learn all there is to be known about the human body. And Father Brennan talks about, a lot of things there as well, which we can't get into. But I've had on the podcast Dr. Michael Agnor, who's a neurosurgeon, twice, and we've talked about some of these things. And I think this is another interesting area of the intersection between neuroscience, molecular biology, and genetics. And this is, I think, something where in a sense, Thomas need to run to because work on and be challenged by, but also challenged, because a lot of the problem with modern science is the underlying kind of philosophical errors. So there's a really good book, Father Cuddy, I've mentioned many times on this podcast, called The Philosophical Foundations of Neuroscience by Bennett and Hacker.
Okay.
And it's great. But one of the things they say is that, you know, a lot of the problems with modern neuroscientific studies is that there's a conceptual error underlying them. So what they say is that we have a degenerate Cartesianism, like a mutant Cartesianism. So instead of having the body and instead of having the mind-body problem, we've just gotten rid of the mind altogether, and we just have the brain and the body. But who is this self that has a brain? Who is this self? Right, the frontal cortex, you know, the frontal lobe decides. I mean, like, who has the brain? And Ben Hacker, I think, is and Bennett, they're both really good on this question. I don't think either of them are believers. I don't know. One's a Wittgenstein scholar at Oxford, and the other is in Australia, a neuroscientist. And I think, in a sense, there's a real need for an integration of Thomistic humanities, as it were, and neuroscience and biology and genetics, because this hylomorphic element, that is the body, soul, embodied persons, taking that seriously and not starting with either materialism or spiritualism, I think is so very important to our understanding of ourselves, our mental health, and also just understanding who we are in the world. And that, as we've said, you know, a couple of times, that's a lot of the source of our problems, whether it's marriage and gender or justice and or politics. A lot of these things come down to anthropological errors. And so, you know, I quote this often, John Paul II said the fundamental error of socialism was anthropological in nature,
yes,
not economic in nature. Now, of course, the economics are deeply problematic, right? But you'd think, we think, oh, this is it's an economic issue. But John Paul, who grew up, you know, under this, said, no, it's anthropological errors. And I think this is where, in a sense, Thomistic psychology has so much to offer. And the way Father Brennan is so open, as it were, right? He reminds me of people like Joseph Pieper. They're not afraid of engaging with the world and with modern science because of this rich non-reductive element. It's kind of inspiring, I think.
Yes, indeed. Noah, you say it very well. And yeah, there's a great moment of hope. I think I view my work primarily as, because for a while Aquinas was forgotten, I view my work as kind of a rediscovery and a rearticulation of St. Thomas and the Thomists who followed him. Mm-hmm. But the next step is kind of a new Father Brennan, new Father Brennans who have that Thomistic foundation and then go out and engage, find the truth, find the insights that might that the modern period can afford us. And that's what we need.
Yeah. Well, and that's the title of your introduction, right? Science, Philosophy, and Thomas Aquinas.
There we go.
That, you know, and I, well, maybe we'll end with this. You start your essay with a wonderful quote from Aristotle. You know, we're dealing with really hard topics. And he says, quote, Aristotle, quote, "To attain any assured knowledge about the soul is one of the most difficult things in the world."
Yes. Because it's so close to us, and yet it's so obscure to us as well. It's so close, it's in us, it gives us life, but yet to find that thing at the heart of who we are is very difficult.
Yeah, and I think that's the, again, you know, maybe Andrew, that's the inspirational part of Father Brennan and the work of the Aristotelian Thomist element. And, you know, and doesn't mean there's no errors, right? There's errors everywhere. We all make errors. You know, St. Thomas, I think he would probably look at some Thomists like, you're more Thomist than I am, you know? But I think the point is that, like, it's really an engaging, this is where you say he's engaging reality and like wrestling with it. And I think maybe begin with, I have a big question for you. And then, but here's a thing that reflects. I always think of this little book by Joseph Pieper on the silence of St. Thomas. Mm-hmm. And here's Thomas, who's like all this stuff, right? And of course, you know this as a Dominican. At the end of his life, he says, he had this vision, like everything's straw. It doesn't mean that wasn't good, right? Because as the Lord, you know, in his vision said, you have written of me well. But that he kind of realized it's so much more magnificent and beautiful. And I think that's in a sense why he's the happy realist, right? Because he's just struggling with reality and engaging with it and trying to understand the person and the world and of course the God, you know, to what extent one can, but he's takes all these things of the goodness of being really seriously.
Yes. Well said. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So, okay. Last big question, and then I'll let you go. because you've got to go here. But here's how would you? I probably shouldn't have saved this to the end. So, but I'm going to. So here's a question I have for you as a Thomist and as a theologian and a philosopher. I sometimes think this, and tell me whether you think I'm on the right track or the wrong track. I sometimes think back to this hylomorphic element, right? Okay, I hear materialists making what Bennett and Hacker called the myriological fallacy. That is confusing the whole and the part, identifying the part with the whole. So like the brain is made into the whole. And so one night I was watching this really nice, like just watching some little Catholic video, and I was tired, and they were going on about the soul and we have a soul and all this stuff. And it was the good stuff. Okay. But I was a little tired and I'm thinking, this is the myriological fallacy. And I thought, wait a minute. These are like all serious guys. And I don't think I was right about the myriological fallacy, but I had this thought that if Thomas came back, do you think he would think a lot of us? And I mean, and I'm not a Thomist like you. Okay. I read Thomas obviously, but not like you, but do you think that he would come back and see all of these Catholic philosophers reading Thomas and say, you guys are all Cartesians. Like, when did you become dualists? Like, you got the thing wrong. Descartes has seeped into your brains. You gotta go back to this more profound hylomorphic understanding. Or do you think that's wrong? What do you think? Maybe I'm wrong.
You ask a question that I have thought a lot about in this particular topic, namely Thomistic psychology, but also in terms of Aquinas's project as a whole. And I must say, dear Michael, yes, I think if Aquinas were to come back here, observe what we were doing in his name, he would not find a lot of the fundamental principles that we possess and think are his. He would not recognize them. I think you're profoundly right. Part of this is we could go on for hours about this, but Aquinas was not, I mean, he was a man seeking to know not many things. He did know many things, but that wasn't his goal. He was seeking to know the most profound and important things and why they were profound and important. And that is so different from modern education and our conception of knowledge, where we think of learning in terms of quantitative extension. I have to have a bunch of facts. Aquinas wants to understand a few key principles that infiltrate, or rather permeate, everything. And because of this, we approach Aquinas in a way that did not approach himself. And so back to the psychological question, I think that you're certainly right. There's a lot of Kantian, Immanuel Kant, his ideas, and even amongst Thomistic writing. There's a lot of Cartesian, René Descartes, his ideas among us. Postmodern ideas, and some of the books that
some are okay, right? Some are not. It's not that everything is wrong. I'm just saying that.
Sure.
I wonder if
it's just what is the first principle. Yep.
Like, wait, he's like, wait, you guys have been infected with some stuff that's just,
it's
like,
true.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, Father, that's a can of worms I opened at the end. So, but thanks for your time. So the book is Thomistic Psychology. And I think that the idea that he's kind of a happy realist, and that the inspiration of him, his work and Father Brennan's work, to just really wrestle with what it means to be a human person with humility is super inspirational, because we're very complex beings. But I think that point that you make, that reading Thomas, he's optimistic, he's hopeful, and it's an encouraging. So I agree. Any last words for us? Thanks so much for joining the podcast.
No, it's been a great honor and a privilege, and I'm very grateful for your kind invitation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.